Yes, and thank you very much for this welcome. It's my first visit to Hull, so I'm delighted to be here and to have been given this opportunity to talk and spend some time with you today. As you may have heard, I think, at the start of one of the previous talks, Mary, my colleague, and I are currently working with Professor Catherine Cochin here in the University of Hull, and we're hoping that we're going to be able to develop a project between the University of Hull and the University of Southampton to investigate and explore aspects of sort of north-south relationships in the 19th and first part of the 20th centuries. We're very excited about this and hoping that it'll go places, and if it does, I'm sure you'll hear more about it too. So it was partly with that kind of context or background that I was invited to give this talk, and Mary will be coming in a couple of weeks' time to do likewise. And you can see I've called my talk Rural England's Perceptions of Country Life and Work in the 19th Century. So let me begin by doing a bit of wondering. I wonder where your notions of life and work in the 19th century countryside in England come from. I wonder what's helped to shape the perceptions that you may have. Perhaps period dramas or adaptations of classic novels on television. Maybe your reading of historical studies or indeed documentary programmes of one kind or another. Perhaps some stories of family history too. Or your reading of 19th century fiction and 19th century poetry. Maybe paintings, perhaps even early photographs. And then maybe visits to museums of rural life or other preserved sites. Some or all of these have very probably left you with particular notions and images of what country life may have been like in the course of a century when so many things changed. And one of the most important of those changes was marked in the 1851 population census, which revealed what has been described as a watershed event, when, for the first time in the history of any large nation, more people were living in the towns than in the countryside. And it's been estimated that between 1841 and 1901, probably more than 4 million people in England and Wales migrated from the countryside, the great majority of them, of course, moving to the rapidly expanding towns and cities. And if we take this city of Hull and the city where I work, Southampton, as kind of examples to illustrate that point, it's quite interesting. Hull had a population of about 22,000 people in 1800, and by 1901, this had risen to about 240,000, so a massive expansion, much of it incidentally in the last sort of 10 or 20 years of the century. In Southampton, the population grew from about 8,000 in 1800 to about 105,000 in the same period. So again, a huge expansion, although at the end of the 19th century, Southampton was nowhere near as big as Hull. Just as a point of information on the side, current figures show that both cities are about the same size. So Hull, I would say, grew less through the 20th century and into the beginning of the 21st century than Southampton did. Southampton kind of caught up in population terms. Well, we take those just as illustrative examples, but it could be replicated with many others, of course. And change of this kind was accompanied by other kinds of change in country life too, at both national and regional levels. So just to give a few examples, there were huge changes to the arrangements for the welfare and provision of the poor, particularly with the Poor Law Amendment Act of the 1830s and the subsequent development of workhouses. Now, obviously, that didn't exclusively affect people in the country, but it did have a particular impact upon them. And the treatment of the poor was an endless source of debate throughout the century, as I'm sure many of you know. Many of the big estates that had been in families for generations ran into financial crisis particularly in the latter part of the century, and a new type of landowner emerged whose wealth had been made elsewhere and whose approach to landowning and the use of the land that he owned was very different. The very way in which the land itself was used and farmed and the crops it produced changed significantly in an age of increasingly large amounts of imported food and a free market economy. And the arrangements for the hiring and retention of labourers altered, with many taken on temporary short-term contracts. Traditional methods of farming were challenged by more scientifically geared agricultural methods and by increasing mechanisation. And of course, very, very important, people of all sorts could move around with increasing ease as roads improved and perhaps especially as the railway network extended ever wider. I would imagine we're all aware, or feel that we are aware, of the scale of the changes and developments that affected towns and cities over the course of the 19th century. But what was going on in the country may be rather less obvious or may seem less drastic. And yet these examples I've given you suggest otherwise. And as evidence of all sorts from the period shows us, contemporary reactions to the implications and the consequences of the changes that were taking place in the countryside were complex and multiple. Such evidence reveals assumptions, prejudices, anxieties, and longings of various kinds. And I'm hoping to indicate some of these to you and to suggest how 19th century attitudes to country life and work, and indeed to the rural population itself, provide us with a way of understanding their experience of living through changes which unsettled long-held views on the structure of English society, and indeed about the very nature of English character itself. And I hope also to show how these responses sometimes have a strong regional inflection and highlight perceptions of difference between the north and the south of the country. Now, you'll have noticed from the title that it refers to rural Englands. And that's not a typographical error, that plural, but rather a borrowing from the title of a splendid book by the historian Barry Ray, a book called Rural Englands, plural, Labouring Life in the 19th Century. And in his preface to that book, Ray reminds his readers that rural England was a nation of incredible local variation. Another of my aims, therefore, today is to suggest the truth of this and to explore how there is more than one way of thinking about and of understanding country life and work in this period, to appreciate the importance of realising that, and to consider something of what it shows us. Well, let me begin by referring to a book published in 1838. And this is William Howitt's book, The Rural Life of England. And in this book, Howitt set out to celebrate the position, the influence, and the achievement of England in the world, which he believed were quite exemplary, and to promote what he called the influence of its moral energy. And he explicitly linked all this to English rural life. This is what he wrote. England, he said, has raised millions of frames, strong and muscular and combatant and enduring as the oaks of its rocky hills. It has nerved those frames to the contempt alike of danger and effeminacy, and has quickened them with hearts full of godlike aspirations after a virtuous glory. And then in a section which is headed Picturesque and Moral Features of the Country, Howitt goes on a bit further. He says, it is indeed a strange relief of the spirit of one who has known something of the eager striving of the world, to come upon a spot where the inhabitants are passing through life, as it were, in a dreamlike pilgrimage, half unconscious of its trials and evils, an existence which, if it have not the merit of great and triumphant virtue, has that absence of selfish cunning, pride, sorrow, and degradation, which one would seek for in vain amid more bustling scenes. Now, the important ideological and moral associations that are embedded in these very loaded assertions are worth noting, because they are ideas which recur elsewhere throughout the period. How it identifies rural life as the formative source of the English temperament and character which have enabled the nation to achieve its place and success in the world. But look at it closely, there's a bit of a paradox here, is there not? Because rural life seems on the one hand to equip people with ambitions and the capacity to realise them, and at the very same time to set them apart from materialism and from the onrush of urban life, which are the very products of those ambitions. Somehow it leaves people untouched by worldly cares, to the extent that visitors to the countryside are refreshed and invigorated by its apparent peacefulness and by the decency of the lives of the people living there. The superiority of rural to urban life is thus very strongly affirmed. And how its confident declarations allow little scope to question either their accuracy or indeed their adequacy. If they were considered in isolation, I think it might be quite difficult to remember that a mere 8 years before Howitt's book, rural poverty and discontent had led to the widespread destruction and violence of the so-called swing riots, which had affected many parts of the countryside, particularly in the east and south. And if we go 6 years beyond Howitt's book to 1844, we find the writer of an article titled Incendiarism, Its Causes and Cure, which was published in Fraser's Magazine, deploring the demoralised and oppressed life of the rural labourer. His wages may be inadequate, his cottage a mere hovel, his wife half naked and his children starving. He may feel all this bitterly and brood over it day and night, but not one word does he venture to utter in a tone of open complaint to anyone. Meanwhile, observe the sort of expression which his countenance has assumed. There's no more disposition to mirth or fun about him. He's always grave, moody, and silent. He walks with a slouching gait. He seldom looks you fairly in the face. He's a discontented man, and in sober earnest, we are bound to acknowledge that in very many instances, he has good cause to be so. Well, self-evidently, that projects a very different image of rural England to that offered by William Howitt, one that is disturbing rather than consoling or uplifting, but one which also alludes to the economic and social realities of rural poverty that are recorded in detail in many other sources, and also to the voicelessness of the labourers themselves because of their dependence on their employer's favour. Central to the article's analysis is the writer's contention that while all the other classes in the community were taking large strides upwards on the ladder of life, the feet of the poor peasant went continually downwards, till now it may be said of him that he is 100 years at least behind the rest of his countrymen in everything. And this decline of labourers' prospects is linked to the economic failure of smaller farms in the depressed years following the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and their increasing submersion into larger and more commercially run estates. As a consequence, the relationship between the farmer and his labourers had become looser and much more bluntly transactional than previously, when the practice of unmarried workers living in their employer's household had been widespread. But again, I think we need to exercise a little caution about accepting this generalised argument in the Fraser's Magazine article. The rural historian Alan Hawkins observes that the landlord, the farmer, and the labourer all had precise relations to social and economic power in the second half of the 19th century. But he then adds, this power was mediated through their locality and through very different regional socio-economic systems. What it meant to be a labourer in different areas of England was literally to live in different worlds. Taking that idea then, I want us to look at some examples of those different worlds through a series of representations. And here's the first one, a painting. Painting titled Harvest, as you can see, by John Frederick Herring, dating from 1857. And I would suggest to you that in many ways here we have an iconic illustration or depiction of one of the central activities in rural life since time immemorial. And if we look at it, what do we see? Well, there's the heavily laden and beautifully manicured harvest load rising into the foreground, drawn by a team of fine-looking horses at a leisurely pace. The harvest is abundant. There's not only the load that we immediately see, but another wagon being prepared in the distance, many other stooks still waiting collection, and more perfectly upstanding grain still to be cut. The crop is secure, even if the heavy clouds in the distance may suggest that the weather will eventually break. The landscape itself, if you look at it, combines cultivated, managed fields, enclosed land, that hugely important event, with adjacent areas of woodland. We can see the big house overlooking its parkland in the top right, and the village in the centre distance, with the church a little in front of it. And the scene contains an important variety of people. The labourers in the field, the man in charge of the horse team, an older man, maybe a tenant farmer, taking his ease with women and a child, and in the distance, what appears to be the landlord on his horse. The art historian Anne Birmingham observes that in this painting, work in all its socio-economic diversity stands for social unity. Everybody has their place, their part. The numerous rural classes represented in the painting are seen against a landscape that, with its fields, church, village, park, and manor house, echoes and hence endorses this diversity. But Anne Birmingham goes a bit further. She says, distinctions of class, the labourer's activity and the landowner's leisure, are accommodated in a landscape that makes such differences seem natural and even unimportant in the context of the collective interdependence of worker and landowner and their mutual dependence on the land. This image provides a kind of visual equivalent to the rural world evoked by William Howitt. It projects an image of stability and continuity, of harmonious, orderly, hierarchical relations between the different social classes, and of the rapport between the humans and their environment, an environment which itself has been patiently shaped and made so productive by generations of toil. In all these ways, this, of course, is a very reassuring image. One might even think it's a consoling image, especially when contrasted with images of the changes associated with contemporary urban life. Remember, this is a painting from the late 1850s. Much, of course, had happened by that stage. And also when one considers it against the anxieties widely aroused by a rapidly expanding and much less easily supervised industrial working class. Here, people are in their place and are following it, as it were. And I would go so far as to suggest that the appeal of a scene such as that depicted by Herring is not actually limited to its original audience. And that in spite of all the many changes to agriculture and the countryside that have occurred since the 1850s, even for us, Herring's painting contains many features that still resonate with what we think of, what we care to regard in a rather nostalgic way, perhaps, as a conception of rural life and work. In that context, it's worth juxtaposing Herring's image with the famous threshing scene at Flintcomb Ash Farm, described in Thomas Hardy's novel, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, published in 1891. You've got here a picture of a steam threshing machine. And of course, the point about Hardy's scene is that technology has radically transformed the bucolic calm and the quiet rhythms of work encapsulated in the painting. And the novelist deliberately sets up the contrast between old and new methods of harvesting and the implications that attach to this. So we read in the novel, "The old men on the rising straw rick talked of past days when they'd been accustomed to thresh with flails on the oaken barn floor, when everything, even to winnowing, was effected by hand labour, which to their thinking, though slow, produced better results. Those two on the corn rick talked a little, but the perspiring ones at the machine, including Tess, could not lighten their duties by the exchange of many words. The women on the corn rick could stop to drink ale or cold tea from the flagon now and then, or to exchange a few gossiping remarks while they wiped their faces or cleared the fragments of straw and husk from their clothing. But for Tess, there was no respite. As the drum never stopped, the man who fed it could not stop, and she who had to supply the man with untied sheaves could not stop either." Farm mechanisation, of course, increased across the century, although I think not perhaps as rapidly as is sometimes imagined. But everywhere its effects were not only increased efficiency, and that in spite of the views of the old men at Flintcomb Ash Farm who were dubious about the whole thing, but also it led to a transformation in the nature and the pace of work, and of course to a reduction in the number of people actually required to carry it out. One of the appeals of Herring's painting is surely that it suggests a style of life and work that appear remarkably unstressed, however illusory the truth of that might be. But with Hardy, it is actually quite different. Here, the relentless, inexhaustible machine controls the workers, irrespective of their sex, their age, or indeed their state of exhaustion. In an essay which he wrote a few years before Tess of the D'Urbervilles in 1883, if I remember correctly, an essay called The Dorsetshire Labourer, Hardy had already touched on this same subject. And he wrote of how a thin, saucer-faced woman of 55, who'd been feeding the machine all day, declared on one occasion that in crossing a field on her way home in the fog after dusk, she was so dizzy from the work as to be unable to find the opposite gate. And there she walked, round and round the field, bewildered and terrified, till 3 o'clock in the morning before she could get out. Now this sort of disorientation and estrangement and confusion is the sort of thing one might expect to find more readily amongst industrial workers, deafened, exhausted, confused by the noise and the rush and the pollution of factory conditions. But Hardy usefully reminds us that not even the most traditional kinds of labour were immune from the impact of modernity. One familiar group of figures, often associated with harvest fields, but not included in Herring's painting, was the gleaners. Usually women and children, given permission to collect stray and overlooked stalks of grain for their personal use. Gleaning was a kind of time-honoured form of charity to help the poor. But in a description of gleaners, which was published in another important 19th century periodical, one called Cornhill Magazine, in 1865, we find a very interesting process taking place. Because here the realities of rural life are very clearly being sanitized, and poverty itself is being aestheticized for the pleasure of a largely middle-class urban readership. So we're told, for example, of what the writer calls the curious sight of decrepit old dames of 80 down to toddling little brats of 3 or 4, sturdy matrons, and here and there a pretty girl of 18 whose ankles have been rather spoiled by clumsy boots and whose arms are redder than one would wish, but whose trim waist, bright hazel eye and thick brown hair make a considerable array of charms. See the kind of picture that's being painted here. And then the writer announces this: these readers are the gleaners, a class of people dearer to the artist than they are to the farmer or the sportsman. But after all, they are a very pretty adjunct of harvest time, and we should be heartily sorry if any invention of science should blot them from our autumn landscapes. Now, this is a fanciful appeal to a particular kind of nostalgic notion of pastoral England. A notion that I think is implicit in that often used phrase, Merry England. I mean, what on earth is actually meant by that phrase when you come upon it? It seems to allude to some non-specific time in the past, when, again, in non-specific ways, life is somehow imagined to have been better for everyone. More carefree, easier going, simpler and jolly. It actually bears no relationship to the reality of women and children's fieldwork, and certainly shows no sympathy or empathy with it. Consider, in contrast, this early photograph. A photograph of gleaners from the 1850s. Now, it's a bit difficult to be sure what real age these women may have been. But what is evident is that they were clearly people whose lives were very hard, were poor, and were demanding. I can't see any resemblance whatsoever between these women and those described in the article, in that passage which I read you a moment or two ago. They are certainly not, to use the journalist's phrase, pretty adjuncts of harvest time, a phrase which strikes me as quite grotesque, in fact, in context, and which clearly exposes how the Cornhill writer's real purpose was somehow to invent decorative objects, visually appealing objects, that would raise no troublesome questions in the reader's minds. Through the picture, however, we glimpse a very different rural England to the one invoked by William Howitt, by the writer of the Cornhill magazine, or indeed perhaps by the artist Herring. The same point might be made of the words of a Mrs. Burroughs, a woman who recalled her childhood in Lincolnshire in the 1850s. And in her record or testimony, she told of walking between 2 and 5 miles to and back from the fields. She talked of never returning home till 6 or 7 in the evenings, even in the winter time. And she then goes on as follows. She says, in all the 4 years I worked in the fields, I never worked 1 hour under cover of a barn, and only once did we have a meal in the house. And I shall never forget that one meal or the woman who gave us it. It was a most terrible day. The cold east wind, the sleet and snow which came now and then in showers seemed almost to cut us to pieces. Very different kind of picture altogether. And a picture, I think, which confronts us with the specifics of personal memory as opposed to the construction of a generic idealization of labor, such as that you find in the Cornhill magazine. Excuse me just a moment.